First of all, stop it with the abstinence only. Like, just don't do it. Doesn't work. It just doesn't. So, with kids especially, you tell them not to do something, what are they going to do? Like, they just go try it.
Today is a sex and relationships researcher, behavioral health scientist, and psychologist whose work encompasses sexual health, sexual desire and desire discrepancies, as well as national and global sexual education policy and theory. And on today's episode, my guest discusses our understanding, or lack thereof, of what sexual pleasure actually is. Things such as its purpose, why it arises, its peaks and troughs, and how much of a role it plays in human existence. We also look to the future and discuss how sexual education can and should change, and also break down a couple of common misconceptions about ideas surrounding access to sexual education and abstinence. So, with that in mind, please welcome the very, very informative Kristen Mark.
Mind-bending chemicals.
I don't care, he wants to kill me.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
The other thing is that a lot of our research, so the most sort of reliable way to get this information is to be as anonymous as possible, really, or to have participants who have really strong buy-in and trust the researcher. So those are the sort of the two options. Either make it super anonymous or create a culture of your within your participants that allows for them to really trust you. So sometimes we do interview research, for example. I just completed a study where I was interviewing women who had experienced sexual trauma but were now in really healthy, happy, pleasure-filled relationships. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know more about, like, how did you get to that place? And so I built a rapport with these participants. And that was really important because nobody's going to open up to a stranger about that kind of thing. Like, we're talking about very personal pieces of their life. But I was able to get really rich data because that rapport was built. They were invested in the research. They were excited about the fact that someone was looking at this from a pleasure perspective, as opposed to always like the negative sides of it or the negative result. So there are a few ways that we do that, and we are also all very aware that people could be providing us with, inaccurate information, but we control for that statistically as much as we can and do as much as we can in the methodology and in the planning to prevent that.
It's interesting as well what you just said then, that actually in some respect it might be a bit of a positive, purely because the people might feel appreciative that someone actually cares about them and cares about their story and things that occurred for them, which is, I guess, on the flip side, something an astrophysicist doesn't have to deal with, but in a positive way.
Yeah.
And how do you actually build this rapport? Is there sort of any techniques? Is it a case by case basis? Is there a sort of plan that you have for each time, or?
It really depends. I think this is where like therapy training comes in handy. So I'm a trained therapist as well. And so that is a big part of therapy, is you have to know how to build rapport with people. And that therapeutic alliance is one of the biggest predictors of success for therapy. And so having that training helps. But I think also most of us who are doing this research are really genuinely passionate about learning about these things. And I think our participants can sense that. And when you have somebody who is really interested in learning from you, like, that has a level of excitement to it that that really promotes that rapport. Yeah.
Sort of it brings a natural feeling automatically, doesn't it, I suppose?
Yeah.
And when you're doing this sort of research, obviously, again, it's depending on the severity of the situation, but does it tend to coincide with treatment that an individual might be going through, or maybe some other healthcare things that you need to respect or be aware of?
It depends on the study. So for that one that I just mentioned related to sexual trauma, the participants had to have sort of processed through a lot of that already. Wow. But if I were doing a study and that wasn't a requirement, then I would need to be really sensitive to the fact that some people may not have processed through it or may need resources at the end, or, something like that.
Mm. Yeah. And this study you're mentioning, this is the one I think I read about on your website, the trauma and sexual pleasure study, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So now, from knowing nothing about this study, obviously, with myself, I'm imagining there's probably a couple of different ways that this might actually influence how it would change a person's ideas and feelings towards sex or relationships, in probably two ways. Obviously, there's the I guess more obvious way, aversion to relationships or an amount of being uncomfortable with sex or relationships. But then there's probably the opposite way to that as well. It might influence how the things that they like, the type of people that they like, that sort of thing. So what are you looking for in this study? What is the point of it?
Yeah, so that study had a few different aims. One was to understand the resilience and like how that played a role in getting to a healthy, happy relationship. So, you know, what strategies did you try that worked? What strategies did you try that didn't work? That's also really helpful to have information on.
Of course.
And then we were also really interested in sexual pleasure itself. As a field, we have really been a pretty risk reduction focused field. We haven't focused a lot on sexual pleasure. Mm-hmm. And so our understanding of sexual pleasure, I think, could use some work. So I I did this study in part to further understand sexual pleasure, because as you just mentioned, like that aversion piece, there can also be a physiological response of orgasm or arousal during sexual assault. And so in that, you may form an association between that arousal and the trauma of the sexual assault. And so then it can be really hard if that comes up again. Mm. But in a sexual assault, there's no pleasure associated. Like, it's not sexually pleasurable. And so that is the real marker of a difference between a consensual sexual event it's not always, there's not always sexual pleasure in every consensual sexual event. However, in the context of like what we were talking about with these women was, you know, how do you define sexual pleasure? And like, what are the components necessary that need to be there for you to experience pleasure? Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that paper has found that really safety is one of the main things. Okay. And that doesn't sound super sexy,
no.
You know, initially, but
it's not gonna be a movie or a book about that.
Right. But really, like, safety is pretty sexy. I mean, you know, to feel like your partner sees you, to feel like you have trust and like an intimacy that you don't have with other people, that's all very sexy. And so that safety and that feeling of like being able to be your full self was really a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was an insight that maybe people who haven't experienced sexual trauma might not have thought of before. But additionally, it's an insight that I think just is hard to come by asking everyone, right? Mm. We need to ask the question a little bit differently. And so, you know, I think we'll keep looking into that and figure out what exactly sexual safety means. And yeah.
And you mentioned sort of before that as a science, we haven't really delved into pleasure itself. What do you think the reasons are for that? Why has that occurred?
Yeah. So as a society, we don't really we tend to shy away from that unless it's in some sort of an exploitive way, right? Like, unless we're showing it on, using it to sell Axe body spray, or like, you know,
exactly.
Pleasure is really not, it's not taken super seriously, especially not women's sexual pleasure. And so, we also tend to be uncomfortable talking about sex in general. And so if we're talking about it in like a risk reduction, like how do we prevent the bad things from happening that can happen from sex? It's like, that's sort of a safety net for being able to talk about it or feeling comfortable talking about it. So that's part of the reason. Another reason, though, is that there's not much research funding in the area of sexual pleasure. So researchers really rely on funding, but it's hard to get somebody to fund a purely pleasure-based study, which is ridiculous given that sexual pleasure is the number one reason people engage in sex.
That's like, you know, that's a comment on sort of the broader picture and the broader idea of the problem with academia, right? Because it's finding funding for things that maybe people want to get funding for that doesn't necessarily we could get funding for things that would be useful, but maybe people don't want to fund them. That's basically what I'm trying to say. There's probably a lot of occurrence of that.
Right.
One thing you mentioned before as well that I wrote a note about that I sort of wanted to talk about quickly too is you're talking about the associations that people who might have had some sexual trauma in the past, associations that they might have. Like, for example, you said maybe they orgasm during a sexual assault and then in the future that's sort of like a trigger for them, mm-hmm. right? Whatever happened in that instance is sort of a trigger for them. In your experience, in your sort of ideas, I don't expect you to obviously be, I guess, a clinician or tell the future or anything like that, but how should this be sort of approached for a partner or someone who is aware of this situation? For example, I'm sure there are a lot of girls out there who enjoy certain things sexually that might be rooted in something negative that has occurred in their past. So is that a cause for them to stop doing that? Is it a cause for them to be aware of the fact that it is rooted in a traumatic experience? How do you sort of deal with that? And how could a partner or someone else deal with that?
Yeah, I don't think that that's inherently a bad thing for mm-hmm. somebody to be interested in those types. I mean, sometimes that allows you to take the power back, right?
True, like, good point.
By
good
engaging point. In that, it can in a consensual manner, mm-hmm. it can sort of remove the prior meaning that was associated mm-hmm. with it. But I think the self-awareness is really an important piece, and mm-hmm. knowing like what this is rooted in, doing some introspection around that. I think that's really, really key there. I don't think that somebody should, if they're enjoying it then, and like, it's not resulting in, sort of negative affect after the fact, or like mm-hmm. a sort of hangover afterwards of feeling like of negative emotion. Now, if that's happening, then yeah, I would encourage them to like explore that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Are there any things that you sort of occurred that you're concerned about with this negative affect after the fact? Is there any things that you see that are quite commonplace in terms of people, I suppose, spiraling into a worse situation mentally? Or is there anything that you're specifically concerned about?
Not specifically, no. I think that just in general, like if you're engaging in sex, like across the board, whether you've experienced mm-hmm. sexual trauma or not, mm-hmm. if you're engaging in sex and then you're like feeling like crap afterwards, you might want to examine like
self-explanatory,
either who you're having sex with or like why that's making you feel negative. And maybe it's that you were told sex is dirty and sex is bad as you were a kid, and like those problems are coming up. Maybe your partner's really crappy. mm-hmm. Like maybe they're not making you feel very good about yourself. So I think like you should definitely look into that regardless if you're ending a sexual situation and feeling really negative about it.
Yeah, I suppose that's quite clear, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe not everyone.
So we were talking just before about the fact that there's sort of not much research gone into the sort of idea of pleasure because of maybe it's just a taboo subject, maybe there's not enough funding, things like that. So for you, who obviously you can see the ramifications of this, so the ramifications of the fact that we're not actually doing research about things that could be useful, could be important, you can see that it's a problem and it would be better if we could do some more research. What sort of things would you like to change? What sort of, if you had a magic wand, that sort of question, if you had a magic wand, what sort of changes would you like to make in terms of even just within the field of science as a whole? How could we make the field of science better to get more research in? Or even just on a societal basis, what do you think, what changes would you like to make to assist this?
So I think I'll answer the societal one first because I think it trickles mm-hmm. down into the scientific ramifications. But societally, for society to see sex as like a natural part of human development would be really nice. You know, people are sexual from birth until death. And if we could begin to recognize that it is actually a really natural part of development, I think that that would go a long way. It would also go a long way to see it as a health issue. You know, sexual health is a health issue, and sexual pleasure is a human right, and is I mean, the United Nations has declared that to be true. Where are we? You know, why are we not?
Yeah.
And so for those things to happen, you know, I think comprehensive sexuality education that has messages about consent integrated, that has diversity messages integrated, mm-hmm. And that also really emphasizes sexual pleasure as being, you know, the reason that a lot of people engage in sex, that would be really helpful in the U.S. and in Canada as well. It's pretty inconsistent, but in the U.S. it's very inconsistent to the point where each individual school here in Kentucky, which is where I am, each individual school is actually getting totally different information. And so really? There could be a kid who lives across the street from someone and that those two kids are getting totally different messages about sex.
Well, just because it's not sort of organized by the government or?
Yeah, it's not organized. Mm. It's not federally mandated at all.
Right.
It is state by state. And then within some states, such as Kentucky, each individual school, not even school district, each individual school has a site-based decision-making council that makes decisions about what people teach. And so you just have such variability, which makes it really hard to evaluate as a scientist. Like, it makes it hard for me to go in and be like, okay, what is happening and how can we change it? Mm. But it also makes it difficult to know what kids are learning and where the gaps are. We do know that the majority of programs are either abstinence only or abstinence until marriage programs.
Really?
And we know that those are not effective. And so I think if we could see a change in K-12 education related to that, we would go a long way to have like a society that's maybe a bit more educated on, sexual development and sexual health. Yeah.
So what sort of changes would you like to implement in a school system? Because that, you know, like I said to you, I'm in Korea at the moment and there's just sexual education here is entirely non-existent, really. And yeah. You can sort of see the effects of it within the society. And there's someone I know here, she's a comedian. She's a Korean comedian. And she like basically begs the schools to let her go in to teach sexual education to the high school girls. And she just, you know, she emphasizes all these different things that could change here, and I'm sure you could have some ideas about what could change in the U.S. too.
Yeah, first of all, stop it with the abstinence only. Like, just don't do it. Doesn't work. It just doesn't. So
for what reason? Why
didn't
doesn't
we learn
work?
That in DARE? like, yeah, it just doesn't work. It's you know, with kids especially, you tell them not to do something, what are they going to do? Like, they just go try it and then they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So equipping them with information and just being just being upfront about that information and like presenting it as health information, like it is health information. And so presenting it that way is important. Stopping like separating boys and girls for sex ed. Why would you separate boys and girls? They should know about each other's bodies, first of all. Second, with any kids who are gender nonconforming, like that's very confusing and causes a ton more problems. And, you know, we just really should know about, it's just a human body. It's like the uterus does this thing. So let's just talk about the uterus doing this thing as opposed to talking about it in the context of like girls and boys and... It's, you know, I can remember getting that actually in grade 5 or whatever. And I can remember all the boys and girls coming back together after and being like, what'd you learn? What'd you learn? And like, why should that be a secret? We should be able to know what each other learned.
That's a good point. That happened to me too at school. I remember getting separated.
Yeah, I know. It's like we can't handle each other's information.
Yeah.
What? So, keeping boys and girls together would do a lot related to diversity issues that exist. And so I think that, and it would also just help in general for general knowledge. Like, I teach an undergrad sex ed class here, and it is unbelievable how poorly they do on just like the labeling of diagrams.
Really?
You know, it's like, the vas deferens being labeled as a fallopian tube and like, what? and so the uterus being labeled as like the bladder. Like, I've taken pictures of some of the students' answers before and just been like shocked. So, and these are undergrads. So,
right.
You know, they should really know this by now.
They should know that by now.
Yeah,
that's funny. Yeah. Do you think that there are any sort of negative side effects that you might be concerned with I guess greater sexual education? And it sort of sounds opposite to what we're just talking about there, but do you think there is any negative side effects that could come about from teaching sexual education in a way that you're talking about there, like sort of the genders together in a different way, or I guess more in a liberal, more comfortable way. Is there any sort of negatives that could come about from that?
So I think the only way that that could result in negativity would be if the teacher is not comfortable talking about it or right. not equipped to talk about it. You don't want someone teaching sex ed who's uncomfortable teaching sex ed, because that then brings about the same sort of issues around like being like lack of comfort in communication about sex. So that would be the one scenario that I would say would result in more negative outcomes. Overall, more information is better, and comprehensive sex education provides more information. We have a lot of research to show that when you tell people information about sex, even when you integrate pleasure-based messaging, that does not make them go and have sex sooner. In fact, it does the opposite, because then they have the information. Yeah, because then it's like less of a mystery, right? So the Netherlands is a good example. The Netherlands is a great example of this. They talk about sexual pleasure in the context of sex education consistently. And they have the lowest STI rates, the lowest unintended pregnancy rates. They have like their age of first intercourse, if we're counting that as first whatever, I think is a year older than it is in the US.
No way.
And so it's just very different. It doesn't make people have sex. What's interesting is they used to have this exhibit's gone now, but I take students to the Netherlands every summer. So I spend about a month in Amsterdam, and we go to this Nemo Museum, and they used to have this teen facts exhibit where there was this machine where you could like stick your hand in it. It was a tongue on both sides. And it was like, this is what French kissing is. And you like stick your arm into this tongue and someone else sticks their arm into the tongue on the other side. And they like can pretend that they're French kissing with this like machine. It's really cool and also funny and allows for you to, you know, explore in some ways without actually engaging in the behavior. Similarly, there was this whole exhibit where you had to be a certain age in order to get into this part of the exhibit, but it showed like sexual positions. It showed a whole bunch of like different sex toys, what an orgasm sounds like. Like you could go into a booth and listen to an orgasm. Yeah, like just very informational and like no sort of walls up approach. I mean, it was just great. And
I was about to say, I was about to put on my sort of my old school conservative hat, which is it's the old argument, which is like if you do sex ed for kids at a younger age, if you tell them about sex and things like that, then pregnancy is going to go up, STI infection is going to go up, people aren't going to be studying because they're going to be too busy having sex, that kind of thing. But it's interesting you're saying the opposite occurs.
The opposite occurs. And we have data that supports that. Yeah, it does not. That is not the consequence of having more information about sex. Now, it needs to be developmentally appropriate, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're not going into a kindergarten class talking about how to put on a condom. No. That's useless information for them. That's not what they're learning about. So making sure that it is developmentally appropriate is important. But anyone who knows what they're doing is going to know what those developmental milestones are and at what age we should be doing that. That's a misnomer.
That's something that probably makes your skin crawl because you probably hear it all the time, right? So I was sort of asking you, I guess, to flip it and go with the opposite way. I was asking you then what changes you would like to make. So I guess we've seen the discussing sex, well, I could be wrong here, but I think I have seen discussing sex, the ideas of sex, change sort of over time and become more and more liberal. Is that fair to say? It has changed since sort of the 90s, 80s, that kind of thing? Or
It has, I think, maybe societally. We haven't seen that trickle down into the education system.
Okay. Yeah. But sort of on a person-to-person basis?
Maybe.
Maybe. I don't know. I guess it's hard to quantify.
It's kind of hard to say. Yeah. Also, I'm in a bit of a bubble. Like, I'm talking about sex every single day.
True.
So my perceptions are going to be a little off. So maybe you can tell me, has it changed?
Yeah. Maybe I should be saying.
Yeah, you should be telling me whether it's changed or not.
But one of the things that I do sort of, not necessarily get concerned with, but I do sort of notice that as we see sort of more and more, I suppose, portrayals of sex in books, in movies, in magazines, I sort of get the feeling that it could be not pressuring, but changing the thoughts of younger boys and girls about what's changing, maybe what their natural ideas of sex might be like. And this is just a small example that a friend had mentioned to me, a girl who's a friend of mine, who she was saying that she bought a magazine a while ago, and it was just like, it had like a small article in there that was basically saying reasons why everybody should have like blah 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 amount of one night stands. All right. And this is obviously a very small situation, but we were just laughing about it when we have a conversation, because in some weird way, by things becoming sort of more open and things becoming more liberal, in some respect, you're pressuring people who might not be comfortable with doing those things and might not want to do those sort of things, who might suddenly feel like that is the normal thing to do. So, yeah, sort of in, like I said, a backward question, are you concerned, or are there any worries that by becoming more open about these things, there could be certain issues?
So it reminds me of like the consensual non-monogamy conversation around people being like, is this the end of monogamy as we know it, you know? And I think that that's a bit of like, to say that that will mean that everyone's going to go out and have casual sex, like, and it's going to encourage people to have casual sex who maybe aren't comfortable having casual sex. That's, I think, adding a bit of hysteria to it that's not necessary. Because as long as we're always talking about these things in the context of like, you need to feel comfortable and to be comfortable doing whatever it is that you're doing, because casual sex is normal for some people. It's not for others, and that's totally okay. So it's a bit of like, we do this actually in high schools of correcting the misconception of the norm. So like, kids think that everyone around them is having sex when really like no one around them is actually having sex. And so you have to correct that misconception of that norm. And so I'm not sure that we're going to go so far. I don't fear that we're going to go so far that we're going to have to like correct the societal norm. I think that our norms are pretty embedded. Like, our norms of monogamy are very embedded in our culture. Our norms of like coupledom and having sex within a relationship are very embedded. We still see a sexual double standard where like, men are praised for having multiple sexual partners and women are punished. We still see women being the gatekeepers of sex. So I do think some things that have changed, though, back to that initial question, some things that have changed is like, our access to pornography is so much greater now than it was in like, say, the 90s. And many people are using that as their sex education, which can end up being problematic if they don't understand porn, like if they don't have the porn literacy to go along with consuming that porn. So to know that that's actually not how a female orgasm works, and that's like not what most people's penises look like. And, you know, there's all of these really unrealistic expectations that can be placed on somebody if they're really relying on porn to be an accurate portrayal of sex. The other thing is, in addition to the porn, we've seen like with the Me Too movement, there's been a lot more conversation about consent, which is long overdue in our culture. And we really should be integrating way more of those conversations about consent, because not only are boys confused, not only are girls like not giving consent, but boys are also confused because many girls are saying no when they really mean yes, right? Because they've been taught that's what they're supposed to do. And that's a huge problem.
That's a slippery slope. That's a tricky thing.
That's a really, really, really huge societal problem where we need to shift that, no, girls are actually allowed to say yes to sex. And when you want sex, then say yes to sex. You don't have to be a gatekeeper. You know, but we need to get rid of this societal judgment on girls who say yes to sex before they're going to feel comfortable doing that. And so I think that this consent conversation is also really changing the landscape.
So do you think that, you know, that's a great point, because I guess I've always sort of realized that and thought about that, but I've never heard it sort of summarized in a sentence like that. What is the reason, do you think, there is this sort of, like you mentioned, the gatekeeper kind of thing? Do you think, obviously there's societal reasons and probably other a whole bunch of other reasons, but if we do work towards changing that, how much will it change? What is the actual goal, and I suppose why does it still exist in the 21st century now?
So I think it exists because of inequality between men and women. Right. And I think that that's sort of like the backbone of it, mm-hmm. is that we still do have this kind of purity culture, and we do have sort of this like idea that, you know, who's marriage material versus not. And I think we still have those messages, even though things have changed a little bit. We still have that. And until that goes away, I don't think that, I don't think we're going to see the consent. Like the Netherlands is another good example of this. Mm-hmm. They are just taught about consent so consistently from such a young age. When we were there, I can remember us talking to these high school boys. This was 2 years ago or so. And we were talking to them about how just now we're starting to integrate consent conversations into sexuality education in the US. And the boys were like, what do you mean consent conversations? Like, what are you talking about? They didn't know what we meant. And they were like very confused.
Mm.
And that was at first concerning, because we're like, do they not know what consent is?
Yeah.
What? No, they know what consent is, but they were just shocked. They're like, of course you have to ask for consent if you're having sex with a new person. Like, of course you, what do you mean you have to teach that? Because for them, it's like, you need to ask consent to hold someone's hand. You need to like ask consent to give someone a hug. Like you, if you're violating any aspect of their bodily autonomy, you need to be asking for consent, of course. Mm-hmm. Like it was just so natural for them, because it was integrated from birth onward. And when we get to that place, then maybe we'll start to see some shifts in some of this stuff, but we're not there yet.
Okay. And sorry, I've been kind of sort of jumping back and forth from things that you said earlier and things that you said now. You mentioned porn as well, porn, how that's sort of really changed the landscape of, you know, sex and the way we think about sex and the way the next generation are thinking about sex. Porn must be a sort of strange topic for you, because obviously you are encouraging sort of healthy sexual desire, but you also see the shortfalls and the issues that it clearly does bring about. So, you know, it's kind of a vague question, but where do you stand with porn? How do you feel about it, and how should it sort of be treated?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty pro porn, in the sense that I think that as long as we have some porn literacy associated with it, where porn can be a great addition to one's sex life, whether that's like they look at it as a couple, or, you know, or when they're single, it allows for them to have some sort of, you know, some intimacy with themselves. I don't know.
Outlet, like, shall we say?
Yeah. Like, so I think porn is overall, I'm not like anti-porn at all. Mm-hmm. I do wish that we had a little bit more control over sort of ethically made porn, and the free market of the internet doesn't really allow for that.
No.
There's a lot of great how-to porn out there that I think has been brilliantly done in trying to fill that sex education gap. And so some of that porn, but that's the thing is that the really good porn you do have to pay for, and people aren't really paying for porn.
No.
And so I think that that's where part of the problem is, but I really wish that we just had more porn literacy being paired with porn.
Porn literacy. What do you mean by that?
So that's like, it's the sort of education around, okay, this is pornography. This is what you're seeing. And these are the ways in which this is helpful and does show you important information about sex. And these are the ways in which it's really inaccurate. And having that is an important piece, because people don't know. Like they might, if you've never had sex before and you're watching pornography, you might really think that you just go straight into it. And yeah, I don't know. So,
yeah, that's a great term, porn literacy, because the lines between, especially just like you'd mentioned, if you'd never had sex before as a younger person, the lines between what is real and what is not can be super blurry, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely.
And the ages for people seeing porn, again, I keep hearing is sort of getting younger and younger, and that's got to have a huge effect.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, making sure that access to porn is limited at young ages. We see actually that the negative effects of porn that we were just talking about have a lot more to do with your attitudes toward porn than they do watching porn itself, which is interesting.
Such as what kind of attitudes?
So like if you have a really negative attitude around watching porn, like if you just have been always told that you're not supposed to watch it and that it's bad and that it's dirty, and your attitude about it is like, that you feel really guilty, and when you watch it, you do have those negative emotions afterwards, then that tends to lead to problems with porn use more than like if you instead look at the amount of porn someone is watching. That if their attitude is like, ah, porn's fine for me, like it's not going to do anything, I don't have any negative attitudes around it, I don't feel guilty about it, those people can use porn and be perfectly fine. It's not a big deal. But for people who have those negative attitudes and really like ingrained sort of shame around it, that's where it can become a problem.
That's interesting, isn't it? Like the attitude is actually, excuse me, such an important point. And we've seen historically in sort of more oppressive societies, it usually pops up in other areas, right? And it's interesting, again, here in Korea, it's quite sexually oppressed in a lot of ways. And I could talk about it for ages and ages. Like just as a basic example, if you want to buy like condoms and things like that online, you can't see them unless you're 18, things like that. It's just really silly, you know, very, very silly. But, you know, as a funny statistic, there's so much sexual oppression here. And the population of Korea is 52 million. And the population of the US is what, like 350 million or something like that. Yet these two countries have the same number of prostitutes. It shows.
And is sex work legal there or illegal?
No, it
illegal.
Is not.
Okay, I would imagine.
It's
yeah.
illegal. Yeah. So you can you can see it still comes out in other places. And that was sort of the next topic I wanted to talk about is sex work. Now in the US, what's the situation? Is it entirely illegal across the whole country?
There's a couple of states. Definitely Nevada, it's legal in, and maybe another state. I don't know. Yeah, but there's a few states.
Because, you know, this is one of the things where legality-wise, it's sort of, there's greater and lesser degrees in all countries. In Australia and the UK, where I'm from, sort of brothels are legal and cared for by the government. And then in Amsterdam, I'm not sure what the legality is there, but I think it's even more broad. How, similar question to the porn question, what is your stance on prostitution?
So I think that, you know, it's existed forever.
Absolutely.
And it, I think that criminalizing it does nothing but push it underground and make conditions very unsafe. So, I don't think that's right. I don't think I think that sex workers should be respected if it's their chosen profession. Now there's certainly a distinction between sex work and sex trafficking. And those are two very different things. So I think it's important for people to distinguish between those things and not group them together. But in terms of sex work and women who choose to do that as their job, there's always going to be buyers, and we should be creating the working conditions for them to be as safe as possible, which means getting it out from underground, which means making it, there's different degrees of like the ways in which, and I would actually would rather turn to a sex worker to ask them what they would want.
Of course.
You know, because I think that there's different benefits to full legalization versus like decriminalization. And so I would want them to sort of determine what that would be. I know in Canada, they've got, I think it's decriminalized. I'm not positive on that though, but there is like a level of legality to it. To where I think that it's actually the johns, which are the people who go to the sex workers, who are punished instead of the sex worker themselves. How that also plays out in the context of the law changes depending on where you are and depending on how much stigma is attached to being a sex worker. So yeah, I am pro like making the conditions as safe as possible for the women mm-hmm. who are doing that job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you mentioned as well, like this decriminalization situation in which the Johns, like you said, the people purchasing, they are criminalized. And that would seems to me to be sort of a tricky situation as well, because like you said, there's always been buyers, and there's also very special circumstances. There's Louis Theroux recently did a documentary about sex work. I'm not sure if you're aware. He's a British sort of documentary maker, and he followed the lives of people, for example, who had disabilities and who kind of needed the sex work to a certain mm-hmm. degree, and other people's tales who were lonely, who didn't have the opportunity to meet people. So that's also quite a tricky thing to do as well, right?
Definitely, because by criminalizing them, then the only way that they're going to access you is underground, and then it pushes it back underground, right?
Right.
So, yeah, it is really, it's problematic to have criminalization on any point.
All right. So we have about 15 minutes left. Time flies. So I want to talk about one last thing before we finish up, which was one of the other sort of pieces of research that I was reading about on your website, which is sort of the concept of sexual desire as a whole. Now, you wrote something quite interesting, which, again, I hadn't really thought about, that the word sexual desire is quite like a tenuous phrase as a whole, and sort of hard to put your finger on the meaning of it. So can you sort of characterize what that is?
Sure.
For people listening?
Yeah. So sexual desire is a motivational state. It's, you know, the feeling that brings you toward or away from sexual behavior. It's ebbs and flows over the course of your life. It's the psychological component, the sort of subjective psychological component of your sexual self and whether you want or don't want sex.
Okay. And you mentioned that it ebbs and flows. It changes person to person. I suspect it changes, you know,
different relationships,
who it is. Why are we researching this? Why is this important? Why is it something that you sort of care about?
Yeah. So, well, it does, and it changes. So people sort of think about themselves as being a high desire person or a low desire person. Like you kind of hear people talk about it that way.
You hear that all the time.
I know,
yeah.
But that's really inaccurate because it really changes. We know that it's not a trait. So that if it were stable like that, we would call that a trait. But we know it's not stable. We know that it changes. And so it's a state. And so, I'm really interested in it because I think that our motivations around what we do, what behaviors we engage in, regardless of the behavior, this behavior just happens to be sexual activity, are fascinating. And sexual desire is also, and desire discrepancy in particular, where one member of the couple has higher or lower desire relative to their partner. That's one of the top issues to present in couples therapy.
Surely,
and a lot of my work has clear clinical implications associated with it. And that's one that is particularly important, is just how do you deal with desire discrepancy in the context of a relationship, especially when it's like pretty inevitable that that's going to happen, given that both members of the couple's desire ebbs and flows at some point in time.
True.
Right?
So it's never going to be
inevitably
unlikely to
you're
be in
going
sync.
Right. You're going to like have a time in your relationship where you might not have the same desire as each other. So how do you manage that? And so those are some of the reasons why I'm really interested in desire. It's also a sort of at least when I first entered the field, I think we have a way better understanding of it now. But when I first entered the field, it was pretty understudied. And so I found that appealing as well.
Great, great. Yeah. And you sort of outlined three major, I suppose, triggers or important points associated with sexual desire, which is routine, neediness, and we replacing me.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, so three main points. Maybe could you sort of explain what things affect and alter sexual desire within couples and I suppose within individuals as well?
Yeah, so there's a lot of components. I'm not sure which one you read, so I don't know. Like I've written a lot about desire, so I don't know which
it
thing.
Probably all blurs up, right?
Yeah, it really does. But
yeah,
anyway,
I understand.
So what impacts desire? So like your stress levels can impact your desire.
Of course.
For some people, it actually increases your desire. Like if you're really stressed at work, then you just want to have sex in order to get
sense
away from
of relief.
It. But whereas for other people, it actually makes them shut down. And then there's, you know, physical components like health, your physical overall health can impact it. Certain medications can impact it. So all those individual factors that contribute. Then there's the interpersonal factors, which are things like how satisfied you are in your relationship. Like if you just got into a fight with your partner and you're really mad at them, you probably aren't having a lot of sexual desire for them at that moment. Or maybe you are, and maybe like that's that's also part of your relationship potentially. So that's a component as well. The extent to which you communicate with your partner plays into desire.
Okay.
We know that couples who communicate more tend to have higher sexual desire for each other, especially if they're communicating about sexual related things.
Of course. Yep.
Your relationship satisfaction as well, not just your sexual satisfaction, but also your relationship satisfaction. And then there's like societal things that are at play as well. So, the gender inequality stuff that we were just talking about, the extent to which you feel respected in your relationship based on those sort of gender norms, ways in which you feel like you can express yourself sexually or are supposed to feel a certain level of desire or not play into it.
Yeah. The one that sort of interested me, which, you know, it might be 100 published papers ago for you, so it might have blurred up, but you mentioned sort of the aspect of the need for the individualism.
Oh yeah. So me becoming we.
That kind of thing. So how does that sort of play into it? Because I found that quite interesting.
Yeah, I find that fascinating as well. So, you know, you hear about people saying like, you complete me, or like, you know, to become one when you merge with someone. And that's just like such bullshit. And it also like really kills desire. So you need to have individualism within the context of your relationship, like maintain some of your autonomy, maintain some of your own interests for two people to just like mesh into one. Like that just is really, so Esther Perel, who's like a famous therapist who does a lot of really great work in this area. And she talks about like fire needing air, and like, if desire is fire, then we need to like give it a bit of air.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can think about maybe seeing your partner from across the room, like making a group of people laugh, like that could be a real turn on. And if you don't have that autonomy, if you're always attached at the hip, if you like don't keep any of your own interests, then you're going to lose opportunities for that. And so I think that that's a real key component to maintaining desire in long-term relationships.
Yeah, super, super interesting reading that. And I don't know if it's for some sort of bizarre confirmation bias for myself personally, but I've certainly felt it, you know, when I've dated girls. And then sometimes, like you said, you don't necessarily get that individualism, and it's somehow it's just kind of exhausting.
Yeah, it like dampens.
Something happens.
Something dampens, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I don't want to get into too much of a sort of deep philosophical debate in the last 10 minutes, but I also wanted to sort of mention about the idea about sexual desire just over time as well, because this is speaking from me as sort of a man and friends of mine who have similar fears or similar concerns, those that are single, those that are married, those that have girlfriends, about how desire, concerns of desire sort of just disappearing over time, and eventually just unhappiness maybe being an inevitable thing that is going to occur later in life. Now, is this something that you've seen throughout research, that it is commonplace, or is it is there other problems at the root of this? What are your thoughts about that?
So desire does tend to decrease in the context of long-term as relationship length increases. However, that's when we're looking at desire as what we call, and I didn't get into the nuances of the definition of desire in this way, but as it's what we call like spontaneous sexual desire. And so there's spontaneous desire, and then there's responsive desire. And yes, spontaneous desire, so that like feeling that you get in your stomach, like those butterflies when you see someone that's attractive and you're like, oh, I just want to jump you, you know, whatever those, you know, whatever that feeling is of desire, that feeling, you're not going to have that feeling in long-term relationships all the time, right? That decreases as relationship length increases. However, sexual desire can also be responsive. And responsive sexual desire is much more common in the context of these longer term relationships. And what that means is that maybe the arousal will come first and then the desire follows. So like you might like get you really just need to like prioritize sex. And when you do that, then you can re-spark that desire feeling. But you will have to like prioritize sex. It won't be this internal drive toward like wanting your partner, right?
Yeah.
Instead, it might be like, hey, like, we haven't had sex in like a week. We really should do this.
It's time.
You know, like, it's time. You know, so let's just, come on, like, let's just do this. And then you both like just get into it, and then the desire comes. And so the desire may not be the impetus for sexual activity, but it will follow. And so it's just a different type of sexual desire. And so accommodating for that in your relationships, and also having the expectation that that's just the way that that goes. That's okay. Like, that is normal. And it's also can be great. Like, you can find really great things about that to make that work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sort of discussion, that sort of topic is quite a big, I don't want to say argument, because that makes it sounds like it's an argument, but it's quite a big reasoning for when a lot of people sort of in poly relationships say their justifications for being in poly relationships, because they feel as though over time their sort of desire changes. What's the point of only having one person when, you know, I have love for more people? So I guess the question is, you know, how much do you think this monogamous relationship, having a long-term partner for a long time, how much do you think is sort of a societal basis? How much of that social pressure, and how much is that sort of natural, biological, hardwired inside us?
I think it's a combination, as with many things, and that's sort of an easy answer, I guess, but it's definitely a combination. Like, there's certainly some components of monogamy that are socially constructed, but our desire to pair bond is also quite strong as well, meaning like that there is actually an innate sort of component to it. So I think that it's a combination of both, and it's really a matter of what you personally want and being able to talk to your partner about that. Like, if polyamory is something that you're interested in, like, talking to your partner about it and seeing what their thoughts are on it. I think that that can be a really healthy relationship decision, but it's only a healthy relationship decision if both of you are 100% on board. And so, I think we could learn a lot from, like, monogamous folks could learn a lot from the polyamorous community in the communication piece and in the trust piece and in, like, the sexual excitement piece. I think that there's nothing wrong with, like, planning sex, and there's nothing wrong with sort of really prioritizing it and doing things to make sure that you're both sexually satisfied. Like, having those check-ins is important. It's a mix for sure.
I understand. And I guess to the opposite of that, you know, people sort of arguing back, shall we say, is it possible to, have you seen sort of healthy poly relationships over the long term? Because, you know, a lot of people honestly think that poly relationships are just sort of either kidding themselves, or one person is maybe taking advantage of the other person. For example, if one of the partners is poly and has other relationships, while, you know, the other partner is just sort of hasn't expressed themselves in that sort of way. Is that possible to have sort of a healthy, natural relationship like that?
Definitely possible. You know, the research is still pretty early on into in terms of predicting the longer term outcomes. But polyamory has certainly been written about for a very long time. I think that there are many couples who report having very successful long-term 20-plus year relationships that are polyamorous, but not in the case that you just mentioned, where one person is sort of like not communicating their needs. Like, that just doesn't work. You need to have the pillars of polyamory are like communication and trust. And if you're not communicating your needs, then it's not going to work. But we do see that it does work in long-term relationships. Anecdotally, the research to follow polyamorous couples over time has yet to emerge, but...
Cool. Okay. And one last question. I sort of always like to ask, you know, different sort of researchers in different fields, because, you know, the ideas are a lot more realistic than someone who's just sort of guessing. If you could, like the crystal ball sort of situation, if you could look into the future, and let's talk about 50 years or 100 years, how do you think the things that you are researching, the things that you're working on, how do you think they might have changed in that time?
Hard question.
Let's name. I don't want you to sit there and sort of discuss right. each different if different. What do you think? What is one major difference? Do you think that will occur in sort of the next 100 years in terms of what you are working on and what you yeah. care about?
So okay, I'll say like what I hope will occur. Now, do okay, I actually that think that this will happen? I don't know, but I hope that you know we won't have to be. That we won't have to be justifying sex as being like a health issue and pleasure being integral to that health issue. That's like that, because I spend a lot of my time really justifying what I do, right? Like,
really?
This is an important health issue. Like, this is, you know, should be part of like a health curriculum. I spend a lot of time justifying that. And so I think that if I look into a crystal ball, then that is not gonna have to be a lot of. The work that has to be done. It's already been done.
So the crystal ball is in 100 years time, you just want to be justifying it less, basically.
Or not have to justify it at all. Like it's just
at all, or zero
yeah,
justification.
Zero justification. Yeah.
Think of all the free time you would have.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I'll be dead by cool. then. But
All right, yeah. So we're about the hour mark now. So if anyone is sort of interested in what you had to say, they want to learn more about you or they want to learn more about what you've been talking about, what can they look at? Where can they go?
Yeah, they can follow me on Twitter. It's KRISTEN_MARK. Or they can go to my website at kristenmark.com.
Perfect. Yeah. Super easy.
Super easy.
Awesome, Kristen. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, thank you. It was a great conversation.
If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, please subscribe to us, go to any of our social media accounts or website, tell your friends, tell your grandparents, do anything you can do in your power to help us out, because it will allow us to continue doing this podcast for everybody, which we greatly appreciate. Thank you for the support and see you next time.